treason, sedition, rebellion. This is the heritage of the American patriot. Those revolutionaries who stood on principle to fight against tyranny no matter the cost. And that spirit lives strong today in the activists and freedom fighters who fight against the authoritarian state. Each in their own way, each with their own mission, united for the cause of freedom.
I had the idea to run on a platform of fuck the police prior to actually winning the primary.
I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
They said, you don't get to tell us no, we're the state health department, and I said, hell no.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
People already pushing back in ways that didn't even need any votes to be cast.
I'm not ratting on anybody, and I did what I did, so you're going to have to give me what the law says you have to give me.
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
Hope I don't get canceled. Talk to you.
These are the people whose stories I'm here to share. I'm Justin O'Donnell, and this is Submersive.
Man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, anarchists, shit posters, and people of the internet, thanks for tuning in to another episode of Subversive Number 77. As always, I'm your host, Justin O'Donnell. And before we get started, just remember whatever platform you listen on, whether that's YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or on LRN.fm, you can help grow the show by liking, commenting, subscribing, and most of all, sharing with your friends. If you enjoy the content, you can join our production team and the insurgency over on patreon.com/O'Donnell. Again, that's patreon.com/O'Donnell. And make sure to check out our sponsor, snackswag.com, where you can get all of your favorite Liberty merch, including some official sponsored Subversive podcast merch with some great new designs for hoodies, t-shirts, and my favorite, There Is No Political Solution, our favorite little rabbit. He's a little bit angry, but all these designs are available today over on snackswag.com. go give it a visit, give it a go get some shopping for some merchandise where you can literally wear your values, wear your principles, and wear your messaging on your sleeves. Now, if you want to keep in touch between shows, you can follow me on social media and join our community Discord channel where you can chat with other fans of the show at any time. And all these links can be found in the description of the video or podcast you're listening to with that link tree. So make sure you give it a visit and check them out today. So who wants dinner? It's always a fun question. What should we serve? As libertarians, I wonder if there's any meal as delicious and as satisfying to us to devour as one of our own. Our end fighting is legendary and as much a hallmark of our party as our radical thoughts and fringe beliefs in politics. Hell, there's an old joke. Two libertarians walk into a bar and sit down for drinks, and after several hours of intense, deep philosophical discussion about policy, principle, politics, and government, they both leave agreeing on only two things. The first being that taxation is theft, and the second being that that other guy wasn't a real libertarian. This is really captures the mood of libertarian infighting and the one true libertarian fallacies and the arguments that people make about why everyone else is wrong and they're right and their aim to be the biggest fish in the smallest pond. The Libertarian Party started with a question of how big of a tent it actually wanted to be. What level of gatekeeping should be entertained to protect its brand, its identity, its politics, its community? That's a really important question. In the 1970s, the Libertarian Party came to an answer to that question with the Dallas Accords, where they chose that the Libertarian Party would be politically agnostic and on the very existence of the state, that the Libertarian Party wouldn't take a position on whether or not the state should exist and would by therefore be welcoming to both anarchists and minarchists to form the original libertarian movement in this country. No, there were members of both the Republican and Democratic movements who had left and come to that meeting and forming the Libertarian Party. So it's understandable why they would want to form a more bigger tent to bring more people in to present a third-party challenge to politics in this country. And in 50 years, we've never really mounted a successful challenge, having only elected a handful of state reps in New Hampshire, one in Alaska, one in Wyoming now. But in that time, the Libertarian Party has grown. More libertarians have joined. More strangers, Republicans, and Democrats have joined and become libertarians through its process. The big tent has grown. It doesn't just include minarchists and anarchists. Now the term libertarian has grown to include under that Big Ten philosophy constitutionalists, pro-choice conservatives, economically literate progressives, and at some point even communists. We had a Libertarian Party Socialist Caucus that was not only running candidates for chair in LNC, but like had a broad base of support and was welcomed by party leadership as reaching out to the left and as our arm to like embrace the left as we made this hard turn with the Libertarian Party over the last few years. But the tent kind of got too big, in my opinion. Others might disagree, but as any tent, when it gets too big, it's also too small at the same time, because libertarians, anarchists, minarchists, constitutionalists, small government conservatives, they all really tend to agree on most of the core issues that do face this country, that do face the world. They just disagree on application and solution, and even then, it's very minor disagreement. Most work hand in hand. And so this does lead to infighting, though, over which direction of the party should go. When you have such a wide array of differing value structures and moral and political philosophies trying to operate under the same label and ideology within a political party, it's going to be ripe for conflict. It's going to struggle to maintain an identity in the face of inclusion. Tolerance became our downfall. At Porkfest this past summer, Reed Coverdale of the Naturalist Capitalist podcast gave his soapbox idol rant during the ranting competition about how he believed that the problem with one of the problems with the world that was unidentified was the fact that white men were too tolerant, that the Christian conservative right was too tolerant. This is actually a case of that happening, where you have the Libertarian Party becoming a victim of its own tolerance, allowing the tent to get too big and the infighting to become the primary focus of its internal motivations and drives. And again, like last week, I broke this down a little bit in my head before we got started tonight and things I wanted to cover and discuss, because this is a far-reaching and far-ranging issue, and it has led to the cannibalism of our own movement at every step of the way, because we eat our own. Who's going to destroy the roads when libertarians are having each other for dinner? That's the question. Now, for those of you familiar with the Libertarian Party's history, who those have been around for a while, the recent shift in ideology towards more of the paleo right, the paleo conservative strategy for working focused on conservative politics, and it's nothing new. The Libertarian Party's gone through so many cycles in the past, whether it was the Radical Caucus in charge, or the Pragmatist Caucus in charge, or the Old Pragmatist Caucus in charge, or the Old Radical Caucus in charge, or the original Paleo Conservatives headed by Murray Rothbard, who wanted to work with Pat Buchanan and make the party an ally. It really is a cycle of one caucus coming in and pushing another out. This is nothing new, and the Prags act like it was something unforeseeable and unstoppable and needed to be worked to be prevented, and it was the death of the Libertarian Party, when the reality is it was just the next phase of its growth. It was the tent getting a little bigger. Whether or not the tent deserved to get a little bigger, whether or not the tent needed to get a little bit bigger, or whether or not the tent getting a little bigger would eventually be the downfall of the party is a whole different question. But the reality is, as I said before, with all these varying ideals within the Libertarian Party, between the Mises Caucus, the Pragmatist Caucus, the Radical Caucus, the outright libertarians, the Libertarian Socialists, the fundamental agreement is that the enemy should be the state. The enemy is not the people. The enemy is not each other. The enemy should be those working diligently to oppress us at all turns. The enemy is those working to take our money, to steal our livelihoods, to lock us down during a pandemic of the flu. The enemy is agreed upon, or should be, at least. But the reality is these different caucuses don't actually disagree on all that much. And somebody had pointed out on Twitter, I believe it was Jeremy Kaufman who pointed me out to me on Twitter, when I was talking about doing this episode, talking about having this discussion about something he would hope that I would bring up on something that is important. And that is actually talking about the narcissism of small differences, which was fascinating. It's something I did want to bring up. And I'm not sure, those of you may not be familiar with it, but the narcissism of small differences, for those of you who aren't familiar, I'll bring it up on screen. It's a psychological, sociological thesis that states that communities with adjoining territories and close relationships are especially likely to engage in feuds and mutual ridicule because of hypersensitivity to details of delineation. It was coined by Sigmund Freud. A lot of Freud's research is contested, argued, and people disagree with it being held up. But this is something that we can really kind of look at the Libertarian Party as a prime example of, because find me two libertarians in the Libertarian Party, they'll give me the same answers in a vacuum, but then agree the other guy was wrong. The libertarian infighting in the liberty movement is the perfect example of the narcissism of small differences manifested, where we share so much in common with each other that we can't help but to let our differences explode to a catastrophic level. And I think the point where things began exploding on this most current trajectory, on this current line, in my own personal opinion, not codifying this as fact, was in 2018 at the New Orleans convention for the Libertarian Party. There was a final push, something quite similar to the Dallas Accord in the 70s, which codified in the Libertarian Party statement of principles and platform that both anarchists and manarchists would always be welcome in the party, and the party would be ambivalent towards the existence of the state on all official platform pieces. There was a proposal for a resolution that people were terming the New Orleans Accord, the NOLA Accords, which was very similar. It was an attempt to broaden the tent, an attempt to expand the nature of our neighborhood and our tent and who we were accepting as ideological allies with under the term of the Libertarian Party and under the identity of the Libertarian Party. And it was pitched as bottom unity. It was pitched as, in reference to the political compass chart, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, the four quadrant political compass that deviates between not just a two-dimensional right and left, but between conservative and socialist authoritarian and libertarian, with libertarian being on the bottom and acknowledging that there is an ideological realm that exists of libertarian socialism, utopian socialism as preached by anarchists like Emma Goldman and early writings of Marx and pre-communist Lenin and Stalin. The more ideological side of socialism preaches the utopian libertarian socialist ideals, and even practicing anarcho-socialist ideals like the Kurds in Iraq, Syria, and Turkey that live in an anarcho-socialist community where they don't have hierarchical structures and they live voluntarily in those systems, or new commune-based societies springing up in central and northern Syria as a result of the loss of government from their civil war and loss of government infrastructure and support, where they've taken things upon their own to develop anarcho-socialist systems of government with the assistance of people coming in to help them set up the infrastructure and then leaving them to it. But there are real world examples of it working, but it doesn't mean it's tenable as an ally under the same political tent in the American political system. But that political compass, and I'll bring one up here for those of you who aren't aware with it, it really simplifies where one would fall on politics based on your answer to a quiz, whether a short quiz, a long quiz. The world's smallest political quiz prides itself on being 10 questions long and it telling you exactly where you fit. And it's kind of framed to push you in the libertarian box. But it also frames the libertarian right as the only libertarian box, because there was a quiz developed by people who would fall on the libertarian right. It doesn't acknowledge the libertarian left as libertarian. But the move in the New Orleans Accord was to embrace everyone in the libertarian right and the libertarian left who were socialist and capitalist, conservative and progressive, but who opposed authoritarian structures and opposed the state into the Libertarian Party and the Liberty Movement. This got a lot of support from leaders in the Libertarian Party, from LNC members, from celebritarians like Adam Kakash, Nicholas Sarwark, and others in positions of influence at the time, as a push for unity, to end the infighting in the party by agreeing that everyone belonged. And the Mises Caucus, which was small, it was still relatively new at the time, had a small contingent at the convention. They were running Joshua Smith for their candidate for chair. It was defeated soundly by Nicholas Sarwark at that convention on the first ballot, but that in the past, they did have enough support to block that motion from being adopted, to block bottom unity from becoming the official position of the Libertarian Party, and to block the Libertarian Party from officially bringing in those who oppose the notion of property rights, who oppose the notion of personal sovereignty in favor of group sovereignty and collectively owned property and socialism into the Libertarian Party. And I do think this was a good thing, because we live in an age and a time where inclusion, acceptance, and catering to the political sensibilities of the middle and the moderate is the aim and the goal of those involved in not just libertarian politics, but politics in general. And it was at this juncture where the Libertarian Party had a decision to make, whether or not to stand on its traditional historical principles as a more capitalist-leaning, anarchist-leaning party that traditionally opposed the existence of state hierarchies and political structures, while also maintaining support of free markets, open free exchange, and voluntary consent, allowing socialism to have a place within that political philosophy would have neutered it, would have made it invalid, would have made it meaningless. And it was really a triumph for the identity of libertarianism that the New Orleans Accord was defeated. And I say this now as someone who in 2018 was naive enough to give the idea some credence, to say we needed the big tent approach, to believe that our approach towards winning was to open our tent and accept more and more people in, because we needed to compete in the arena of popular politics and populism, and that meant growing our tent bigger. In 2018, I voted in favor of the New Orleans Accord at convention, even though it was defeated. And I was lobbied by Adam Kakesh, of all people, who had convinced me to give my support to the measure. But the Mises Caucus successfully striking that down, it kind of gave life to their caucus. It kind of gave them a second wind and a second chance. And it gave them something to fight against, because it was very clear that those who were pushing the New Orleans Accord in New Orleans would attempt to do so again at the 2020 convention. And now there was a driving mission to keep the Libertarian Party a party that focused on property rights, a party that opposed aligning itself with anyone who opposed the notion of property rights. And in 2020, the Mises Caucus came to the convention with a much larger contingent, still not a majority, but it was a convention in the heat of controversy with the circumstances of COVID-19 pandemic forcing the majority of the convention to be remote. People weren't allowed to attend in person. There was a very small contingent of nominees. The nominee for the party ended up being Joe Jorgensen, who, a very principled, radical libertarian who ran as Harry Brown's running mate in the past. And this was exciting, where you had anarchists like Daryl Perry at the time, before he went off the rails, saying this was such an improvement from Johnson Weld, and it was great to see a homegrown libertarian receive the nomination for the ticket. Joe Jorgensen, she was fantastic. She was known as being incredibly principled and radical and a great communicator when she ran as Harry Brown's vice presidential candidate in the past. Harry Brown had often complimented her as being the principled part of the ticket. It was a dream to a lot of people like me who were disheartened and upset with the Johnson Weld campaign for how they gave up the identity of libertarianism and campaigned as independent moderates. Because libertarianism isn't a moderate position. It isn't a moderate philosophy. And when we branded ourselves as socially conservative and fiscally liberal, we allowed our ideas and politics to be defined by the attitudes and interpretations of the right and left, as opposed to reinforcing the notion of libertarian ideals. And that bothered me to a great deal, and bothered others even further. But even Joe Jorgensen ended up being a compromise candidate that many in the Mises caucus, because of her past work, could support. That many of the PRAGs, because of her past work, could support. That many of the non-affiliated, non-caucus members in the party, because of her history with the organization and her principled stances on liberty issues, could support. And then her campaign went off the rails. Spike Cohen was her vice presidential candidate. And to this day, everyone loves Spike Cohen. Spike Cohen is one of the best representatives of the libertarian message out there. He is one of the greatest modern contemporary messengers of libertarianism. He travels the country helping people fight the fights that need fighting and do what needs doing. But his campaign team largely came from Vermin Supreme. You know, people like Richard Manzo and others who were open libertarian socialists who campaigned with Vermin Supreme on a platform of free ponies and mandatory toothbrushes and tried to claim it was a libertarian philosophy when in reality it was just a mockery. And when these people got in charge of Joe Jorgensen's campaign through their infiltration by action, we ended up seeing things like Joe Jorgensen's social media taking a hard left turn pandering policy-wise. And at the height of a global pandemic, the greatest expansion of federal government overreach in history, maybe even certainly our lifetimes, and the greatest tyranny that most people will ever know in their lifetimes, happening in real time in front of us, the world coming to a halt, businesses being shuttered, stopped, people's livelihoods being destroyed, our people's savings being devalued through inflation as the government printed $6 trillion to hand out in corporate bailouts to their friends and lobbyists. The issues that the campaign wanted to focus on were Black Lives Matter. And Black Lives Matter is an important issue. It's one that has terrible PR and horrible political affiliations tied to the organizations behind it, but the principles of the issue do matter. But how much can Black Lives Matter when everyone's unemployed? How much can trans rights matter when small businesses are being shuttered left and right by government dictate and government order? How much can bodily autonomy matter when it comes to abortion rights? When the government is trying to force you to inject an experimental vaccine? The Joe Jorgensen campaign decided it wanted to pander to the issues it thought voters on the left wanted to hear. Because the Joe Jorgensen campaign thought that was where the greatest chance for success and measuring their success at the ballot box stood. But in doing so, they alienated their base. They told libertarians that the issues we cared about didn't matter to them. They told libertarians that the greatest expansion of tyranny in our lifetimes, the greatest expression of militant tyranny in history, would go unchallenged and uncombated by the leadership of the Libertarian Party and its candidates for president. And that shift in priorities really, really bothered a lot of libertarians. And Joe Jorgensen didn't get the support she needed. In most states, she didn't even get the libertarian voting base. Most candidates for U.S. Senate, governor, or other races that were running as libertarian that had the same statewide voting district as her outperformed her by a margin of almost 2-1 at the ballot box. Candidates who campaigned on radical messaging of ending federal overreach, of ending the lockdowns, of supporting private small businesses and individual sovereignty over the state doubled her vote totals. Because libertarians couldn't bring themselves to vote for someone who couldn't stand up for what mattered at that time. And it was during this period of time that we saw a lot of luminaries in the Libertarian Party, people like Nick Sarwark, who in the past Nick Sarwark had been a standout, a radical. Nick Sarwark, he gave a successful none of the above speech to oust the pragmatist chair and vice chair of the Libertarian Party and to usher in a radical takeover of the Libertarian Party in the past, but had since become the chair of the LNC and the cheerleader of the Pragmatist Caucus, who had his own principles, his own radicalism had gone out the window, campaigning with Joe Jorgensen, working for Joe Jorgensen. Something happened between his move from Phoenix, Arizona to Manchester, New Hampshire, where his priorities shifted and his attitudes shifted, and the way he acted and engaged with other libertarians shifted in a negative manner. And he was demeaning, demanding, and confrontational with people. And when anybody disagreed with his interpretation or understanding of events, you were labeled an enemy. You were put down. You were talked down to. And it was his attitudes and how he interacted with people that led to his neighbors, his supposed friends, Free Staters, the largest collection and coalescence of libertarians in the world here in New Hampshire, shunning him and tuning him out and basically excommunicating him from their community. And when that winter came, the next Libertarian Party of New Hampshire convention came, there was an upswing in attendance where a bunch of new motivated members of the Mises Caucus had chosen to join the party and get involved and do something with the party's leadership at the state level. And when Nicholas Sarwark ran for treasurer of the party, he lost to none of the above. But he lost by a margin of votes that exceeded the number of Mises Caucus affiliated attendance. He had pissed off enough people that even long-standing members of the party who had once called themselves his friends voted against him and voted for none of the above to leave the office vacant and to alter the bylaws so somebody else could take the seat, rather than to put him in a position of leadership. And Nick didn't take this well. The falling out of Nick Sarwark with the Libertarian community in New Hampshire and the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire is such a minor part of the story, but it's such an important part to tell about what comes next. Is Nick began to set up his own institutions, his own structures, his own infrastructure, where he said he would work outside of the party, against the party. He couldn't stand to not be in charge. He couldn't stand to not be at the forefront, to not be in the lead, and to not take charge of what he thought was the only appropriate way to campaign, the only appropriate way to represent libertarianism. And when others opposed him, others disagreed with him, others wanted to try a new approach, to try something different, to not repeat the same thing that had been failing for 50 years, he decided that meant war. And he decided his principles no longer meant he would support libertarianism for libertarianism's sake. He would support libertarianism as an occupation, source of income, and way of life that benefited him. Fast forward to January 6, 2021. It was such an auspicious day. We're actually leading up to the next Libertarian Party convention. It's been almost a year since Nick Sarwark has lost to none of the above. And protesters and rioters and LARPers and a man in a costume and senile elderly people on a guided tour of the Capitol building have the entire country in a tizzy, in a frit, in a fantastic heap of nonsense where people think it's the end of democracy as we know it. Where people become convinced that a bunch of idiots who have no clue what they're doing, no plan, and no chance of accomplishing anything are the biggest threat to American democracy since the War of 1812. No, I take that back. They're probably uneducated enough that they don't know what the War of 1812 was. But these people will tell us that they believe January 6th was the greatest tragedy in American history and that everyone should be held accountable. It was an insurrection. It was treason. The reality is it was a grandmother and a man in a bear costume on a tour of the guided of the Capitol. Capitol police opened the door. They escorted them. It wasn't as violent as people want to claim it was. There was violence. It was a riot. I've been in more violent riots in Boston. I've been attacked by Boston police more violently than those protesters attacked the Capitol. I've been assaulted by both Antifa and the Proud Boys in Boston more violently than anyone attacked that Capitol building. And still the Boston police have done the worst. But I made comments about how January 6th was a failure. It wasn't going far enough. They should burn the Capitol to the ground. Maybe this was time. Was this the start of the revolution? Was the boogie happening? Were we preparing to do something finally? Were there going to be 435 6-foot lengths of rope needed to be shipped to the Capitol? I don't know what was happening, because the news wasn't really telling us what was happening. We found out over the next couple of days about what actually happened, as memorabilia pieces taken from the Capitol went up for auction on eBay. But that day, it was a stir-crazy news cycle. And I remember when a friend of mine had put out a tweet or a Facebook post, I forget which it was, saying that the real traitors and the real terrorists were the 435 members of Congress, not the insurrectionists who were rioting, demanding their voices be heard by their elected representatives. Nick lost his mind. And Nick Sarwark insisted that anyone supporting the riots was a terrorist themselves. Nick Sarwark insisted that we were wrong and unlibertarian, and we were the enemies if we thought that Congress was a terrorist organization. And I'll reaffirm here, the United States House of Representatives and Senate as a body of Congress is and should be considered a terrorist organization and an organized crime syndicate all in one. I will say that for the record, and I will stand by it until the day I die. They are responsible for more death and suffering in this world than any other group of people alive, including actual terrorists and including tyrants and dictators. But this was the final straw. It broke Nick's back, the camel's back, or the straw that broke the camel's proverbial back. And it cemented the separation between the new wave of the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire and Nick Sarwark and the old guard. Now, in the interim, prior to that, like, there had been a coup, so to speak, in 2021. Shortly thereafter, the new party leadership chose to, it was the 2021 convention. It was after the January 6th comments where Nick was actually ousted and voted against with NOTA. That was my mistake. We'll correct that record. But that summer, after the Mises Caucus had taken over Libertarian Party of New Hampshire, which is a strong word, Nick to this day accuses myself and AJ Olding of facilitating the Mises Caucus takeover of LPNH and destroying the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire. The reality is, all we did was show up to a meeting that was advertised to people who are interested in the Libertarian Party and recommend they read up a little bit about Robert's Rules. We did nothing else. All we did was be friendly to our neighbors and invite them to the convention. The fact that they took over the party, well, it belongs to the people who shows up, in the immortal words of Nick Sarwark. But Jaletta Jarvis, Brian Shields, Richard Manzo, Leslie Ann Peterson, Kelly Halderson, George Carpenter, a few others, with the assistance and instruction of Joe Bishop Henchman, the national chair of the Libertarian Party at the time, attempted to stage a coup where they stole the property, digital assets, and intellectual property in name of the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire, tried to expel all of its members, declare themselves the new rightful leaders of the party, and say the Mises Caucus evil, bad, unwelcome, unliked, and no longer allowed to play with us. This, to make a long story short, ended up with Jaletta and Brian and Richard and Nick all becoming uninvolved in the state party. All of the party property and assets returned to the rightfully elected leadership of the state party. Joe Bishop Henchman is the chair of the National Party, resigning. Tucker Coburn, board member of the National Party, resigning. There was a few other resignations of people who resigned before being implicated in what was happening, and a change in leadership in the party. And honestly, I do believe that had the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire coup not happened, the Mises Caucus takeover in Reno might not have happened as a result. It was definitely a motivating moment. It was a wind chime to signal the breeze, and the breeze was shifting in corruption, malfeasance, theft, and fraud was enough. And all of this struggle and all of this fight and the corruption was over so little. Another interesting sociological principle or law or something to bring up is Sayers' Law. For those of you, again, unfamiliar with it, Sayers' Law states that in any dispute, the intensity of feeling is inversely proportional to the value of the issues at stake. It adds, this is why academic politics are so bitter. Libertarian politics is academic politics. It's not practical politics. You're not getting elected. You're not implementing change. You're not accomplishing anything. Unless you're a libertarian who lives in New Hampshire, who registered Republican or Democrat, ran and got elected to the state house, then by all means, you're doing practical politics. But the reality is, if you're engaged in the Libertarian Party, it's academic politics. It's a marketing and messaging campaign to make more libertarians, to convince people of our policies, practices, and politics, and ethics, and morals, so that eventually, someday, maybe in the future, at some possible time, we might get some voter election reform, in which case we can get a new system which will stand a chance. But the reality is, it's an academic pursuit. And anybody who doesn't recognize that the Libertarian Party is a purely academic pursuit is out of their goddamn minds and out of their depth. It's a political pursuit for sure, but it's one based in academics, not practicality. If it was practical, you'd pack your bags, move to New Hampshire, and run for office and get elected. You wouldn't be circle jerking on Facebook groups and bitching and moaning about platform blanks passed by the LNC in Reno. But I digress. Slayer's Law. Like, in any dispute, the intensity of feeling is so inversely proportional to the value of the issues at stake. The value of the issues at stake in the LPNH coup were the keys to a fucking Twitter account. The only thing at stake being fought over was who got to type 280 characters targeted at some shit politician on the internet. That was it. The Mises Caucus had created a communications committee, including a few members, one of which was Jeremy Kaufman, who were in charge of the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire's Twitter profile. And I'm not going to sit here and tell you that it was all dandy, it was all fine and fucking great and non-controversial and people overreacted. There were some shit takes posted from that account. There was also some great takes posted from that account. The difference is, every take posted from that account was incredibly principled and on-platform and could be defended. That's something people didn't want to hear, because the first one to really bring up big controversy was a tweet from Jeremy Kaufman under the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire's name that read, children should be free from school. They should be allowed to work. It was an endorsement of child labor is better than the U.S. Department of Education for educating our country's youth and our securing our future. And I'm sorry, but libertarians in Massachusetts or Ohio or California or anywhere else that were offended by that, I don't care. Because in our academic pursuit of libertarian politics, we do need to differentiate ourselves from the Republicans that are already promoting the core of our values. And in New Hampshire, the Republican Party's slogan is taxation is theft. In New Hampshire, Republican candidates put up platforms for secession and abolishing the federal government, for not just nullifying federal gun laws, but declaring war and arresting federal agents who try and enforce them. New Hampshire Republicans are more libertarian than libertarians in most other states. So pushing the needle is what needs to be done to differentiate the Libertarian Party in this state. Now, can you do that tactfully? Probably. You can do it more tactfully than what Jeremy did, sure. But the craziest part is, later that year, the New Hampshire House of Representatives passed a new law, and the governor signed it into law, repealing a bunch of restrictions on child labor and making it easier for kids to opt out of school and go to work. So what you thought was crazy, absurd, and obscene, and way off the deep end of the libertarian Overton window that we were pushing too hard, is now a matter of law in New Hampshire. The truth is, we didn't go far enough. We need to lean in harder. Because a petty squabble over Jeremy Kaufman tweeting principled takes that you didn't like the audacity of led to the upset of the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire's leadership, led to the resignation of a third of the board of directors of the Libertarian National Party, and a complete overhaul of the elected leadership at the next convention, led to the evisceration of some pretty old and longstanding platform planks at convention that people wanted. There was such a fight, and there was such a catastrophic fallout because y'all wanted to fight over a Twitter account. And you didn't even win the fight. Libertarian Party of New Hampshire's Twitter account is still in the hands it was. But all you've done is made yourselves irrelevant with the infighting and the petty bickering. And you made them, you made the Mises Caucus choose you as an enemy, as a target, as someone who would no longer be welcome, persona non grata. And congrats, now they're the majority. And they're not willing to work with you. But that doesn't mean you need to poison other people against them either. Because while it still is an academic pursuit of liberty, it still has a chance to win hearts and minds and to grow the libertarian movement in the future, it can't do that when libertarians are its greatest opponent. After the 2022 convention, Jeremy Kaufman was nominated to be the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire's candidate for Senate in New Hampshire. It is fantastic. Incredible. I'm ecstatic about it. Jeremy Kaufman is running a very principled, radical campaign for U.S. Senate. What we're going to do is I'm going to pull up one of his campaign ads, one of his shorter ones, and show you why you might understand why people like Nick Sarwark, who think that libertarians are respectable, that libertarians can win in mainstream politics, that libertarianism is not such a fringe ideology, that a majority of people will accept it if we can just reason with them, because 50 years of evidence hasn't convinced them otherwise. But Nicholas Sarwark thinks that a campaign ad that just makes a mockery of the notion of politics, that makes a mockery of the issues of corruption, bribery, and graft in politics, wouldn't appropriately represent a candidate he would want to support. So when we air this commercial and others like it,
they say to dress for the job you want, not the job you have. And I want to become a lizard person. I would like to rule you. I'd like to lie to your face and then do something else because it benefits me. I would like to be as corrupt as possible. I would like to enrich myself and then tell you it's for your own benefit. I'm Jeremy Kaufman, and I'm running for U.S. Senate.
So who's shocked that Nick Sarwark thinks that's offensive, that we shouldn't be doing things like that, that we should be better representatives of libertarianism by being more respectful and pretending to be what we're not, because we're not Republicans, we're not Democrats, we're not career politicians, we're not the hacks, the lobbyists, the pieces of shit that infest the swamp of Washington, D.C. We're the people who care about liberty and freedom, and we are the people who understand that we are a minority. And we're not going to reach people with reason, because people aren't reasonable. We're going to reach people with emotion. We're going to reach people with humor, with laughter. We're going to make people think, make people come to the conclusion of liberty and freedom on their own. Make people understand that corruption, graft, grift, and fraud is an actual problem in politics, but not by simply saying it and pointing to the numbers on the FEC database about Maggie Hassan's $30 million from corporate lobbyists. No. Make them think they're voting for someone honest. Make them do the research on their own. Make them pay attention. But Nick Sarwark finds this idea offensive. He finds somebody with Jeremy's Twitter persona to be offensive. He finds the very notion that somebody other than him got to be in charge of the pick of candidates in the Libertarian Party in New Hampshire, that he went and recruited his own. Kelly Halverson, running for governor against Carolyn Borisenko, Chris Sununu, and whoever the fuck, Tom Sherman, the Democrat. Kelly Alderson, uninvolved in the Libertarian Party, never lifted a finger to help, hasn't collected a petition in her life. I don't even know if she's voted Libertarian. She campaigned for Ron Paul, but he was a Republican at the time. But Kelly Alderson is so offended by the notion of Jeremy Kaufman running for Senate that she's running for governor to oppose him. Yeah, she didn't even get the office right, but that's a whole nother question. So Nick needed to pick a recruit a Senate candidate to fill out his slate, to fill out his hacks, to fill out his little team of busybodies that were going to fly in and sabotage the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire by sweeping votes from under us by running a real Libertarian campaign. But he couldn't find anyone in New Hampshire to do it, so he found Kevin Kahn from Ohio. And when Kevin first declared he was running for U.S. Senate, when Kevin filed his paperwork with the FEC to run for U.S. Senate in New Hampshire, when Kevin announced he was moving to New Hampshire and running for office as a Libertarian, Libertarian Party of New Hampshire did not react well. How the Free State Project did not collectively react well. Kevin had had some experiences visiting with the Seacoasters and members of the Shell and said he had a great time and great meeting people, but he didn't get a welcome wagon. He didn't get a new mover's invitation. He didn't get people integrating him into the local community off the bat. He didn't get people welcoming him out to brunches and social events. And people didn't invite his wife to social events because he was Nick Sarwark's friend. He was Nick Sarwark's puppet. He was carpetbagging here from Ohio to sabotage all the work we've done in fixing, repairing, and growing the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire because Nick Sarwark was mad. And that was unacceptable to people. People attacked him on Twitter. People made fun of him, mocked him, called him stupid. Nobody reached out to talk to him. Nobody asked him what his side of things were. People in New Hampshire's Mises Caucus became so offended by the notion of someone not liking their slate of candidates that they treated them just like Nick Sarwark treated them. Now, for those of you who don't know, I am working on a new book. It's a compendium, a series, a composition of stories of libertarians and their motivations and how people come to the path of liberty independent of academics and personal struggles and personal victimizations of the state. And I actually reached out to Kevin to interview him for one of those stories. He's got a fascinating story. Kevin Kahn was a business owner, import-export, travels internationally a lot. He was very apolitical up until COVID-19 radicalized him, like much of the Mises Caucus. When traveling back from Mongolia with his wife, an immigrant, and his daughter, a dual citizen, they had a run-in with a federal agent who tried to accuse his wife and daughter's passports of being fake and detained them as illegal immigrants, even though they were both U.S. citizens. And I don't think many libertarians realize how dangerous of a situation that is. How terrifying of a situation that is to watch your family's safety be placed in the hands of a federal agent who you don't know, who clearly has some motivation against you, some bias against you, some systemic and inherent institutional reason that they're targeting you. That'll radicalize anybody. It prompted Kevin to get home and search how he could get involved in politics and landed himself with the Libertarian Party of Ohio. And then the Libertarian Party of Ohio, he's on great terms with the Mises Caucus because he's a doer. He goes on petitions. He campaigns. He organizes. He helped people run for local office in Cincinnati. Kevin's issues with the Libertarian Party of New Hampshire come from just being geographically separated from us, from not knowing us, from not being a part of our local culture and our local community. When he was a political organizer in Cincinnati and for the Libertarian Party of Ohio, organizing nonpartisan races for mayor of Cincinnati, major offices that had Libertarian candidates trending well, and then Cincinnati's Inquirer and mainstream media in Cincinnati started covering the Libertarian Party out of the blue in a negative light, talking about Jeremy Kaufman and New Hampshire's Twitter account. His candidates dropped out. They backed off. Nobody wanted to associate with him or the party. He didn't know Jeremy. He didn't know me. He didn't know us. He didn't know the Mises Caucus of New Hampshire. But he knew Nick Sarwark. And he already had plans to move to New Hampshire. not of the Free State, but he has family connections here. And so the only person in New Hampshire he knew to reach out to, he didn't know, was on the outs with everyone else here. That person asked him to run for U.S. Senate, didn't inform him of the situation on the ground. And as someone motivated to be the change he wanted to see in the world, Kevin agreed to run for U.S. Senate. He still had a campaign committee from when he ran for Congress in Ohio, so he filed the paperwork and he decided to come to New Hampshire, drive to Concord, pay his $100 registration fee, and start and put his name as a declaration for the Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate. And that action alone, without knowing any of his motivations, without knowing any of his politics, his policies, without knowing any of what he stood for and what he wanted to fight for in New Hampshire when he got here, was enough to turn the majority of libertarians in this state against him, to consider him an enemy, simply because of his affiliation with Nick Sarwark, who they considered their enemy. This is a dangerous mentality. This is the consequences of cannibalism. We eat our own to the point where those who should be our natural allies are afraid to join forces with us. We eat our own to the point when those who are pushed away and forced to leave feel so gutted that they feel the need to actively work against anyone they left behind. And I understand it. I've been guilty of it myself in the past. The height of the drama, I was once quoted as saying, "Let the bridges that I burn light the way." Because anyone I'm leaving behind should be forgotten and buried. I'm no longer sure that's the case. I'm no longer sure there isn't a path to redemption. I'm no longer sure that Juletta Jarvis has no future with the Libertarian Party. I'm no longer sure that Nick Sarwark has no future with the Libertarian Party. People can be redeemed. People can come back. But we as a movement will never grow beyond our own flaws if we don't grow up and start destroying ourselves at every opportunity. There's an epidemic of people who chase titles in the Libertarian Party, and there's not enough people willing to do the work. The Libertarian Party has become a civics club of resume builders, of people who aren't willing to do the necessary, people who want to be celebrity chefs, so to speak, of libertarianism, but aren't willing to support their line cooks, their prep cooks, and their servers to make sure their meals get served. The Libertarian Party has a class of leadership that doesn't know what it means to follow. The uninspired trying to invoke passion in others, and the unprepared trying to give directions to the unwilling. People care to chase titles, accolades, awards, rather than petitions, votes, referendums, or change. Our big fish aren't getting any bigger. And our pond won't expand or flood if we keep breaking its dam and chasing away our allies. I don't claim to have all the answers. I don't claim to be blameless in the drama and the infighting that's happened. I did my fair share to drive Nick Sarwark away. I felt personally victimized by him, by some of the things he said and the attacks he made, the friends that he turned against me when he chose to walk out that door. But I'm glad I got to know Kevin Kahn. I'm glad I didn't let my biases against Nick Sarwark turn me against an ally in the fight for liberty. Someone I hope can be a force for good within the Libertarian Party and the Liberty Movement here in New Hampshire. Somebody who now on the ground is willing to do the work, willing to fight, willing to step up where it needs. Somebody who knows what it means to do the work himself. Well, we're sitting here wrapping up the 2022 petition drive for ballot access for Jeremy Coffin and Carlin Borisenko. I have struggled with my mental health and trying to organize volunteers, and our volunteer coordinator, who's about to lose her goddamn mind at any goddamn minute because people being so unwilling to commit to do the actual hard work when it matters. So my challenge to libertarians, before you type that snarky tweet, before you send that next DM, before you spread that next little bit of gossip, before you answer that group text that you've been putting off for a couple hours, take a look around and see what's going on that you can help with. And instead of being part of the problem, even if it's a problem you didn't realize existed, figure out how you can be part of the solution to the problem that hasn't even presented itself yet. The next time you have a county meeting, next time you have a convention, find a friend who's not involved in the Libertarian Party and convince them to come with you. Grow the base, grow the pond. More medium fish is better than more big fish. This academic pursuit of liberty only works if we work together. And while we do need gatekeeping, we do need to draw the line on what libertarianism means, we do need to commit to keeping out socialism and those who don't respect private property rights. What we don't need is to cut ourselves off from potential friends and allies because we're too willing and ready to eat our own. That's all I have for tonight, guys. It's been longer than I thought it would. I'll be perfectly honest with you there, but thank you all for tuning in. Thank you all for listening. Thank you all for the comments on Facebook, YouTube, Odyssey, and elsewhere, and Twitch. And those of you subscribed or aren't subscribed, hit that big red subscribe button right down there below. Get notifications every time I go live. Next week, we're coming back with our interview series. We're going to have another guest next week. Big surprise. I'm looking forward to it. And thanks to our sponsors, SnackSwag.com and Anchor.com. Best place where you can host a podcast, and it's free. And a shout out to our patrons, those who make the show go on every month: Stefan Kinsella, Jeremy Slatcha, Mike Dalgish, Jeremy Kaufman, Robert Daniel, Josh Richards, and Tony Spaghettio. You guys are the best. You guys are the team. Thank you so much. Till next time, live free. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Subversive. Make sure to like, subscribe, and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live on YouTube. And make sure to leave some comments and reviews on whatever platform you listen on to let me know what you thought of this episode. And a huge thanks and shout out to our sponsors and the awesome members of the Insurgency on Patreon. If you enjoyed this content, you can join the Insurgency on Patreon by following the links in the description for patreon.com/odama. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, CastBox, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts every day. So until next time, everybody, be free.